Hello and welcome to Developer Marketing Stories. Now, in every episode of this podcast, we are going to speak to someone who's launched a product, community, or service aimed at developers. And we're going to ask them to reflect on the journey that they took so that we can help to unpack some of the advice and learnings from their story that you can apply to your developer marketing program.
I'm Adam Duvander. I run a developer content agency, as well as developer marketing training with Matthew.
Yeah, and I'm Matthew Ravel. I run Hoopy, which is a developer marketing, developer relations agency, and also I am the founder of DevRelcon.
And of course, another reason that we're doing this podcast is the developer marketing training that Matthew and I run. It gives you 6 to 12 months of coaching and feedback and really the tools that you need to be a better developer marketer.
So if you want to level up your developer marketing career, whether you're coming from a non-developer form of marketing or you're coming from more of the technical side and you want to learn the marketing side, then take a look at developer.marketing. You'll be able to sign up, get access to at your own pace training, as well as that coaching that Adam mentioned, and join a community of learners. So developer.marketing. Okay, Adam, who are we speaking to this time?
We are talking to John Gottfried, one of the founders of MLH, Major League Hacking, which is a community of developer learners, primarily college developers, and learning through hackathons and other events. And they have a really unique story for developer marketers. And that's why we wanted to bring them on here, because of the way that they structure that learning. And we got to dig into a lot of that from the early days of MLH's story through how they are helping developer marketing companies like your own be able to reach developers.
So John, you and Swift founded MLH. Could you take us back to the time when you were both working at different API companies and you had this inkling that there was an opportunity there?
It happened very organically. Swift and I was working at Twilio. He was working at SendGrid. And this is now, you know, more than 10 years ago, right? So we're talking 2009, 2010, 2011. We had both just graduated from college. And, you know, a big part of our role at the time as developer evangelists was community building, mentorship of both our customers and general developers. And, you know, building connections with a lot of different local groups and, you know, builders, right? And, you know, for both of us, community had been a big part of our stories, becoming developers and getting into evangelism in the first place. And so MLH was sort of an organic extension of that. Basically, what happened was there was a small nascent group of university like hacker clubs and hackathons, maybe five of them at the time. And, you know, we had become friends with them. Swift had been traveling around to a lot of the events to basically help them run smoothly. And, you know, some of the organizers were asking him and I about, how do we build more connection between different campuses? How do we actually make this something that's bigger than just our one school? And through a lot of, you know, zigzaggy paths, like that eventually became MLH. But really in those early days, it was born out of a very immediate desire to just have connections between a lot of disparate groups.
On LinkedIn, it says that Swift started a few months before you did, right? And so it sounds like that was that time where he's sort of traveling. He's like, oh, I guess this is whatever becomes MLH, right? Can you take us to the exact moment where the two of you said, okay, this is a thing, like Swift has already left, you know, a fast moving startup. You're at one that, you know, arguably is bigger. It did acquire the other. So what's that moment?
We had a long running bet about that, actually.
About which would acquire which?
Yeah, basically which one would end up being more valuable. I think I won, but you know.
So what is that moment where you say, okay, this is the time to leave and join this new thing?
Yeah, I'll tell you guys like the sort of like raw story, right? Like Swift and I were good friends. we were also roommates at the time. And so we spent a lot of time together. We hung out a lot. We, you know, brainstormed crazy ideas. We did hackathons together. And, you know, Swift had a previous company with some of his friends from college called Hacker League, which was sort of like a precursor to something like DevPost. And they were in the process of selling that to Mashery and Intel. And so he quit his job really to focus on that. But the real story is that we had gone on a vacation together to Berlin, and we sort of made a pact to quit our jobs and start a startup together. MLH wasn't really on the table yet at that point, but we knew we wanted to work together. We both went back home, told our bosses we were leaving, and his boss was kind of like, wow, it's been amazing working with you. Like, sorry to see you go. And my boss was basically like, nah, you should really stick around a couple more months. And so I failed to quit my job. And so Swift left his job, was focused on selling his company, and in that time started, you know, MLH by like traveling around and helping all of these organizers. I was sort of in those first 6 months, like behind the scenes, like I would give him advice on different things. We would work together on some proposals. Often I used my expense account where we would sponsor a hackathon and he would sleep on the couch in my hotel room for free. And so there was a healthy amount of collaboration, but like he started working out full time about 6 months before I did. And it was in those 6 months that MLH really sort of like sprouted up through this organic community like need. I quit my job in, I guess it was the end of March 2014. And that was when we started working on it full time together. But, you know, it's, I think like a lot of founding stories, it's often an indirect path. That's just like when the timing feels right. Like by that point in 2014, it was clear that this was not just something that Swift could do alone flying around. It was clear there was a lot of excitement and demand around it. And honestly, it was something that we were both really excited about on a personal level because we loved working with like students and developers and people who were building community. And it just felt right. We had no idea of what the business model would be. We had no idea how big it would become, but it felt right, like the right way to spend our time.
What was the product that you were selling?
In the early days of MLH, the product that we were selling to companies was effectively just like packages of sponsorship. So rather than negotiating with five different events, we would have a standardized package that we sold directly to the companies. To be honest, like that didn't scale very well. We found very quickly that we quickly exhausted people's travel budgets faster than they exhausted their sponsorship budget. And so even though people would sponsor 5 or 10 events, they couldn't even go to all of them. And so we had to evolve pretty quickly from that. But like the early sale was just standardized event sponsorships. Now it looks a lot more like a programmatic, like high scale, you know, developer marketing program. But it took a lot of iteration to get there. But for the students in the early days, the main value prop was we connect them together. We have some shared values and we do rankings of all of the schools that participate.
What were the steps that you took in those early days to make your brand one that would appeal to developers?
I actually think that this is one of those challenges that a lot of developer communities encounter eventually, of how do you balance the needs of your community versus the needs of your corporate customers. Coming from Twilio and SendGrid, we both had a pretty opinionated view on what made a good developer experience. Things like, even if I was at an event representing Twilio, I would gladly help someone debug a competitor's platform, or I would go, you know, assist someone with an issue that was totally outside of the scope of them becoming a Twilio customer, because there was a feeling that as a representative of the company, you were building goodwill, you were building relationships, and ultimately you were building a positive like brand impression, to put it in really corporate speak. And so that was like a guiding principle in those early days of MLH, where, you know, we were going to events representing our corporate sponsors, but we would help people no matter what. And, you know, we made sure that the hackathons themselves like shared a lot of those values, where it is first about the developer. It is first about learning and growing your skills. It is first about the experience of the attendee, because if you can't create a positive attendee experience where people are learning and having a good time and building something that they're passionate about, you know, it's never going to become sticky, right? Like, you want people to come back. You want them to have that aha moment where they can't wait to come to another event that you run. And, you know, if you go too far in the direction of it being a, you know, corporate event, often people leave feeling like it was a transactional relationship and not a growth oriented one. And we were very conscious of that even from the early days. And there's a lot more to that, but really it's about putting the developers first. And over time, as we became a B Corp, like, we actually enshrined that in the company, like the mission of the company, which is like legally in our operating documents, is to empower hackers. And so, we are accountable to that more than anything else.
But you do have corporate sponsors who have to then turn around and provide metrics to someone. How do you sort of balance that? I mean, the philosophy that you've shared, I think, you know, Matthew and I fully are on board with that community first, developer first philosophy, but somebody has to explain that back.
The way that it manifests for a sponsor is very different. Like, developer platforms want to be involved with communities that are healthy, right? They get more value out of it. They get more ROI when they are involved with healthy, thriving developer communities. And so the ROI is really about brand awareness, developer acquisition, use cases, and in some cases, talent acquisition. None of those things are really possible if the developers aren't having a good experience in the first place. For example, let's say that you bring a platform to an event that doesn't have a strong self-service motion. Developers go to their website, they're going to churn immediately, right? Like, this has to be something where people can understand how to use it. It is in our best interest to provide tools to developers that are like well understood, easy to use, like easy to intuit, so that the company actually gets those signups and people using the platform in a meaningful way. And so you have to like consider both sides of it, right? Like, neither one really exists in a vacuum, because when you're doing grassroots developer outreach, you can't afford to have a sales engineer sit next to every person who's signing up for the platform, which is often how a lot of those enterprise developer platforms grew, you know, before the days of developer relations.
When you gave your notice to your boss, you were somehow talked into staying longer. Did they say, John, you're crazy to go off and start your own thing?
No one said I was crazy. Twilio had, I think, a healthy respect for being a launchpad for people. And I had a good relationship both with my boss, Rob Spector, who I still am friends with to this day, but also with Jeff, the CEO. And, you know, they did the thing that good employers do of asking, you know, how can we keep you? Is there anything we can do? Like, you know, what are we missing here? And for me, it wasn't about that. Like, I loved my job at Twilio, and I thought it was an exceptional place for me to work. But as a someone who was in their early 20s and like had all of this energy and sort of like excitement around startups, it felt like the time was right to do my own thing with a close friend of mine. And so I think they understood. Really, the pitch for getting me to stay was like a bit more utilitarian, right? It was like, you have a lot of projects in flight, you know, don't leave us hanging, you know, like help finish up the things that you've committed to. And like, that was a reasonable pitch, right? Like, I did not want to leave on bad terms, and they had not put me in a position where I wanted to leave on bad terms. And so it was totally reasonable for me to stick around for 6 more months to like see through all of these different things that I had going on, and do more of a straightforward, like, offboarding.
And so there was a timeline that you both agreed to there with that?
It was loose. Like, we didn't actually agree, like, I will be gone in 6 months, but it was more like, you know, finish some of the stuff we're working on, see how it feels, and let's talk about this later, right? And I think that for me, it gave me time to, like, reflect on, am I ready to go, like, do my own thing, right? And, you know, it's interesting because I had done a lot of side projects. I had had a lot of fledgling startup ideas that didn't go anywhere. And, you know, you see all this mythology around starting startups in the media. The reality was nothing like that, but I still wouldn't trade it for anything. Like honestly, staying at Twilio would have been incredibly lucrative. I'm sure I would have learned a lot. I'm sure it would have, you know, been a huge impact on my career in the developer world. But, you know, when you are doing something on your own, there is a forcing function where you must figure out all of the nuts and bolts of how to run a business, how to build products, how to sell, how to, you know, manage a team. And I felt like that was a huge, like, accelerant for my expertise and career, and also something that I just really enjoyed. And, you know, I think that we did it in the best way we could have. Like, Jeff, the CEO of Twilio, came back as an angel investor in MLH when we raised our first round. So, like, I don't think we did it in any way that burned bridges, but it was just a leap of faith.
Tell us about that leap then. So some time passes, you have to tell Rob that you're leaving again. what's the moment when you realized, okay, it's done, there's no turning back now?
I think it was in December or January of that year. So we had first had the conversation in, like, July or August when we got back from Berlin, I think. And then maybe it was earlier. Either way, I know that I finally talked to him in December or January about leaving in April. I think he saw it coming by that point. Like, I had been planting seeds of it for a long time by then. And they had just made some fantastic hires. So, like, right around that time, they had brought on, I think, Ricky Robinette, who ended up leading that team in the future, joined. Greg Baugus joined around a similar time. I think Matt McKay had just joined. And so they were hiring pretty aggressively. And perhaps, you know, that made it easier for me to leave. Like, and I won't say I was, like, the linchpin of that team. Like, it was very much a collaborative effort. Like, there were a lot of really fantastic people there. But I think it, you know, had become obvious that I was on the way out and would finish up and leave. You know, Twilio came on as one of our first customers. Like, I do think that we understood the current model of developer relations at that time really well and had something to offer a lot of those teams that were trying to scale their reach.
So there was a point, so you'd left Twilio, Swift had left SendGrid, and you were both now full-time. Was there a moment where you realized that you'd kind of crossed a threshold? There was no turning back.
Yeah. So our first big customer was Dell Computers. And we had built a relationship with their team and effectively made a pitch to them as they were launching their Linux laptop, the Sputnik, that, like, to put it, like, bluntly, like, developers didn't care for their brand. And that Mac was eating their lunch. And with a Linux laptop, they had an opportunity to gain a lot of developer mindshare and preference. I had been using the laptop. Like, I was a huge fan of it. I had friends who were really into it. And so we made this pitch to their leadership that, like, they should be the flagship sponsor of MLH. The amount of money we asked for was, like, more money than I had ever seen in my life. And I, you know, distinctly remember, like, signing that contract with them and, like, basically, like, Swift and I sitting there saying, like, you know, like, either this is going to go really well and it's going to be a huge accelerant for our business, or we're going to get sued to death and, you know, fail miserably. And it was, like, a very, you know, there were, like, these two polar options. Like, either it was going to be exceptional or it was going to be a total disaster and we were going to get sued by this massive company. It ended up being really successful. Like, they were a partner for, I think, 4 years. But, you know, that was the moment of no going back. because we had now accepted so much money from a customer that to not execute on it would have been like disastrous.
How did you actually set the price?
I honestly don't remember how we set the price. I'm pretty sure it was some combination of asking people in our network what they thought it should cost, looking at what an individual hackathon sponsorship cost, and then coming up with the biggest number we thought was like possible. There was no science to it. Over time, we developed a much better understanding of like unit economics and, you know, sales prices and all of those things. But really, it was just like a moonshot kind of pitch. And, you know, I think for them, once you really get into it and you're looking at these like huge companies that do consumer marketing spend, you know, like Apple could spend whatever, like $1 million on like a movie placement or something. Like the money is like silly money at a certain point. And I actually think that in retrospect, we were a really good bang for their buck. But for us, it felt like just like the biggest number we could reasonably ask for without being laughed out of the room.
And is that you had the first ever season of hackathons that they were sponsoring? And is the sort of polar ends that's basically how well that season goes determines how well Dell's experience goes? Is that kind of what it was?
Yeah. So at the time, we were rapidly growing. So we went from like 5 events in a year to like 40 events in 6 months to 100 events in 6 months, like really, really quickly. And so a lot of it was like speculative about the growth of the events. Like, could we support that? Like, did we literally have the time to do all of those events? Because there was only Swift and I, and maybe we had a couple of interns at that point. And would people show up for the events, and would the events be successful? Like, there was a lot of, I would say, optimistic planning. And, you know, not all of the events were perfect, but the underlying premise that we could be a shared infrastructure for people building developer communities and events did play out. It was incredibly exhausting. Like, Swift and I were on the road constantly. And very quickly had to hire people to even just like get the bare minimum of work done. But, you know, the real question about whether we would fail miserably or succeed was, could we execute on what we had, you know, promised? Like, not just the number of events, but like at each event, could we do the thing that we were imagining for Dell, which was to expose developers to their platform and make it a good experience in a scalable way? Like, things like, if you get really deep into logistics, like, how does freight shipping work? How do you ship 30 laptops to an event? You know, we had to figure that out, and it was a lot of trial and error.
So you've got Dell as a customer. How do you get the developers there to the hackathon?
Almost all of our developer marketing has been word of mouth. And this is kind of one of the magical things, I think, about MLH and our community, is that it is highly localized and distributed. And so most people who go to a hackathon, and now, you know, some of our online programs or fellowships or things like that, find out about it from a friend. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about it in the context of a university experience. Like, how do you go to a party? How do you go to a club meeting? Usually someone you know invites you. The same is true of hackathons, but like to a greater degree, because you're committing to an entire weekend away from campus. And so it's not as simple as like, come spend an hour at this club meeting. It's like, hey, do you want to like drive for 6 hours and go to this crazy event where you maybe stay up all night building stuff? And so you had to have a pretty compelling pitch from someone you trusted. We saw people going classroom to classroom, like literally pitching, you know, their peers on campus. Yeah, we saw people using Facebook groups to build community, to rally people from campus to campus. We saw people who were like super fans of MLH, literally like driving around to all of the campuses nearby to pitch this idea of hackathons and the culture they were trying to build. There was just like an enormous amount of energy and passion around it. And we still see that today. It looks a little bit different, but like, it is all word of mouth and organic. And we've basically like never spent a dollar on marketing to developers, because it is such a compelling experience for them that they just keep wanting to be there. And that's, you know, been an intentional thing, but also something that is, to me, like a sign of a really healthy developer community.
So you've just described, I think, the holy grail for many developer marketers. You didn't spend a dollar and you got super fans who were driving around, despite being college students with no money, to go around evangelizing on your behalf. So what was your pitch to those people who became the super fans?
In those early days, I don't know that we were pitching super fans or even intentionally creating them. The experience spoke for itself. We had people where every single weekend of the semester, they were at a hackathon. It was their social scene. It was their professional scene. It was like their passion in life. Like I equate it sometimes to, you know, college sports. Like people do travel around following their college football team because that's the like center of their experience on campus. The same is true of hackathons. You know, when you say it's the holy grail of developer marketing, though, I think that it's that is a really interesting statement to me, because I have seen other companies do similar things where they are able to create such a compelling experience that fits the needs of their developer community that they don't have to do a ton of paid marketing. You know, when I say that we never paid for it, like obviously we were paying our team, you know, so there is a staff cost, but we didn't do advertising or anything like that. And I think that for grassroots developer communities, that is often how they work, that you are creating content, you're creating experiences, you're creating peer connections in a way that creates like a flywheel for the business to get more developers involved. And that doesn't necessarily include paid advertising as an acquisition strategy, in my opinion.
I guess what I meant was that you're creating super fans, people who will act as force multipliers for your program. And that is, you know, people put a lot of effort into champions programs, into, you know, ambassadors within individual accounts when they're doing account-based marketing and that kind of thing. Whereas for you, yeah, I guess it is the holy grail. The thing that you had to offer was so compelling that the rest just came naturally.
Yes. And I think that that is in contrast to how most champion programs function. We did not, like, because there was no structure to our super fan effort, people could make of it what they wanted. For some people, they wanted to be a leader, right? Like they wanted to build something on their campus. For some people, they just loved hacking and like creating projects. For some people, it was their social experience, right? Like they just wanted to see their friends. A lot of different people got different things out of it, but really they got out of it what they put into it. And I think the problem with a lot of champions programs is that they end up being very heavily structured and incentive based. And the best incentive is something that's intrinsic, right? So if you are, and I see this at Twilio too, and I've seen it at a lot of our customers at MLH, like they all have super fans. Like whether or not you choose to support those people with the resources of your company is a different question. But like at Twilio, it was very common for people who just like enjoyed using the platform and had created something cool with it to go talk about it without ever speaking to us. And that was encouraged and often rewarded in a way that felt like a magical moment to people and not a transactional relationship. And I think we've thought similarly about it from MLH. Like, oh, wow, like you went to 10 hackathons this year. That's really cool. Like, why don't we like send you a t-shirt? You know, why don't we like help pay for your gas money to another event? Why don't we like go to your school and help them fund a bus to get from school to school? You know, all of those things were not offers. They were responses to the things that people were already doing because they loved it so much. And I think that the best champion programs look similarly, where it's about like rewarding people for the right behaviors that they have come up with on their own.
I think that's going to be really compelling to folks who are probably sitting in that exact spot trying to design that that champion program now. If we can go to sort of that, again, early days, two of you, you've taken this this huge check, which I assume was a large check, like a sweepstakes. was there, you two were doing so much of what you'd never done before. Was there someone who you would reach out to and sort of have as a sounding board?
There were a lot of people we reached out to as sounding boards. I mean, basically everyone we worked with at Twilio and SendGrid and beyond became our, like, you know, advisors and sounding board. You know, certainly we talked to Rob, we talked to Jeff every once in a while. I know Swift talked to, like, Tim Falls and people like that. Like, there were a lot of folks who were experts in this that we reached out to all the time. I don't think either of us was ever so, like, proud as to think we knew everything. Like, we depended on advisors from the very beginning, and we continue to this day. Like, you know, Adam, like, we've talked to you before about how do we, like, create awesome developer content for our community, right? Like, Matthew, like, we've talked a lot about developer relations and community building. Like, I think that DevRel in particular is a field that is highly collaborative and not secretive. And we leaned really heavily into that. And we continue to do the same in offering what we've learned.
What were some of the things that people told you that really helped you to either overcome a problem or really just push things forward?
This is perhaps counter to what I said previously, but one of the biggest pieces of advice that Jeff from Twilio gave me is that when you're starting a company, it is very unlikely that you will be able to hire your way out of problems. You can hire people to solve operational problems. You can hire people to bring new expertise on the team. But really, it's up to the founders to solve a lot of the core design and structure problems of the business. And that was a mistake we had made. Like, in the early days, we had perhaps over-relied on outsourcing our lack of expertise. And I think the reality is that when you have advisors and when you have peers that you can talk to, you need to take all of that information and figure out what to do with it, because it is unlikely for a small company that someone you bring on board will have the necessary amount of context and depth of understanding about your community to solve these, like, existential problems for you. And that's not to say that, like, you know, MLH could only exist with Swift and I, but I do think that, like, you know, in the early days of a startup, it is up to the founders to figure out their existential direction, and that you can't hire your way out of that, even if you can rely on and integrate the advice of other people.
Yeah, you couldn't abdicate those big choices that someone had to make.
Yeah, like sales is a really good example. Like, I had no background in sales, and I kind of took it on from the beginning. And, you know, we worked with a handful of different sales advisors and hires over the years, many of which were fantastic. But we found that if Swift and I didn't intimately understand sales process, proposals, billing, like, all the elements of it, that it would still not be successful, because we needed to understand what was going on and where to go strategically. And that didn't necessarily look like how other companies did it. And so hiring someone, they could often be an incredible executor and, you know, strategic driver in a certain direction. But that didn't necessarily mean that they knew how MLH specifically should do sales.
Yeah. And so there'd never been an MLH before. So this must have, those yeah. early days, it must have been a lot of experimentation. And what were some of the things that you tried along the way?
I mean, we tried a million things. I mentioned, like, the API, like, standardized packages, like, that didn't work for very long. We had this premise at the beginning that every event needed to be staffed by someone at MLH. As you scale to 100 events, you know, every 6 months, we didn't even have enough people time to do that. Like our team was traveling constantly. And so we quickly had to figure out how do we like build a more scalable like workforce, you know, like how do we get more people involved in this in a way that they're representing MLH at events. That took a ton of trial and error. We had to figure out like what are, you know, the finances of this, like how much does it cost to staff a hackathon? How much does it cost to serve our organizers in the way that we want to? There's a million things that you dig into as you go on. And, you know, like not all of it worked very well, but, you know, you figure it out, fail and move on.
In the past, you've spoken about there was some number of students across the world who have worn an MLH t-shirt on campus, and that acts, you know, some other number of students see that. Can you tell us about some of the experiments that you did then around reaching more student developers?
One of the things that we realized really early on is that being a hacker and like being an MLH like hackathoner was part of someone's identity. And people like to share their identity with both visual and spoken indicators. And I realize that's like a very like academic description of what's going on here, but like people have jargon. Developers have jargon. You know, like, you know, when you see someone else with those stickers on their laptop that they might have some shared values and interests to you. You know, when you see someone wearing a startup t-shirt, you know, when you see someone like, you know, sharing something on social media in a certain way that like, hey, like they're into tech too. And so we realized that like t-shirts especially were a really powerful visual indicator of like belonging to a community. And this was perhaps something that like we learned from Twilio and SendGrid, where like people would joke that they were swag companies, right? But MLH legitimately has produced hundreds of thousands of t-shirts at this point. And we use them as a way for people to identify with one another, represent this thing that they're passionate about, and feel like they are part of something bigger than themselves. Like, we change the design every year. We give them out in a limited quantity, and we, you know, see that paying itself back. Like, it is not uncommon for me to walk around New York City and see people in MLH shirts. Like, this is very much a thing that people, you know, feel as part of their story and their journey in becoming a developer. And the designs have to match that level of passion, right? Like, they have to be cool. They have to be interesting. They have to be something people actually want to wear. And I think that's just like a really powerful thing. And I actually think a lot of companies, you know, underestimate swag, but like in order for it to be effective, it has to be something that resonates with people and actually like represents their interests.
So what were some of the non-scalable things? Because obviously printing hundreds of thousands of t-shirts is a big thing.
There are a lot of things that start out non-scalable that if they work, you eventually have to figure out how to scale. So a really good example of this is the coaching that we provide to our local organizers. Like, MLH is a distributed network. There are hundreds of local chapters that put on their own meetups and hackathons under the MLH umbrella. And in the early days, like, those people were personal friends of Swift and I. And so we were chatting with them on Facebook Messenger. They were calling us every once in a while. We would meet up for coffee in person. And that was how that coaching happened. Over time, as you have hundreds or thousands of those organizers, you have to figure out how to scale it. And so we basically had to build like processes and frameworks and open source documented guidance for how to do a lot of those things. And I've seen the same thing happen with a lot of developer communities where like your developer advocates or your developer, you know, relations folks or whatever you want to call them, develop personal relationships with members of your community that are really powerful. How do you replicate that for tens of thousands of people? Like, how do you build something where peers are giving each other advice or your team can give advice in a one-to-many format or whatever it is? But, you know, like taking the core bit of like, we need a human to provide advice and guidance and coaching to other humans. is something that often starts out very, very unscalable, that if you are successful needs to scale in novel ways. Other things that we did were, like, in the early days, we facilitated a lot of the transportation between events. And that's not to say that we, like, literally reimbursed everyone for gas money, but, like, okay, let's go to a school and get 60 people so we can fill a coach bus, right? That doesn't scale very well. And eventually we had to teach schools and students how to do that on their own. But that was one of the early strategies that we literally did in-house through trial and error and, like, pure elbow grease to cross-pollinate the different campuses. And so I think that, you know, there's a lot of things you have to try. Even t-shirts, though, you know, it's easy to say, like, oh, you get a vendor and outsource that. There's a lot more logistical complexity to making it happen. And, you know, it took a lot of trial to get it to a point where it was, like, an easy to predict, you know, stable engine of distributing, like, cool swag that people actually liked.
So what were some of those things, whether with t-shirts or other projects, that didn't work so well?
One of the things that I think didn't work very well was the first iteration of, like, our staffing program. So we call it the MLH Coaches Program. The first version of it was basically, like, we have these passionate community members. They want to represent MLH at events. Let's pay for their travel costs and just let them loose, right? We quickly discovered that everyone had a different idea of what a successful, you know, weekend looked like. People focus their time on different things, and that in order for us to, like, sort of, like, make sure that all of our local communities had a comparable experience, and also that our, like, sponsors and corporate customers had a comparable experience, that we needed training and we needed structure and we needed feedback, so that at least, like, the coaches that we were sending to events had a playbook of what they should be doing. And I see this with developer, like, advocates too, right? Like, sometimes you go to an event and someone is there, you know, providing a ton of value. Sometimes you go to an event and, you know, you see people at a booth where they're on their laptop and they don't seem particularly engaged. I don't think that's a malicious thing. And I don't think that's a personal, like, ding either. I think it is more often than not a lack of, like, training and expectation setting for, like, what it means to be out in the field. And we've had a lot of things like that. Like, the staffing program is a good example. How we provided support to organizers is a similar example. And I think that, like, as any community grows, like, documentation, standardization, resource sharing, like, all of that stuff becomes really, really important, so that you can, you know, give people a good experience no matter where they are or where they're at.
Were there any times where you felt as though the problems you were facing were insurmountable?
Often. I mean, I think that when Dell changed their strategy and was not a customer anymore, we had to make up a lot of revenue really quickly. That was definitely a forcing function. More recently than that, in 2020, we had a community of hundreds of in-person events that suddenly couldn't do that anymore. And over the span of weeks, we had to figure out, like, what do we do with all of these people that were planning to throw and attend hackathons over the next year, right? And it's interesting because, like, there were sort of two parallel solutions to it. One was that we had to reinvent what a virtual hackathon looked like. The other was that we had to build novel new programs like our fellowship that served a different core need that our community members had. So on the hackathon side, no in-person events, right? Everyone's going to get COVID. Let's go virtual. Our team put a ton of time into figuring out, like, what does a live virtual hackathon look like as compared to a long-running asynchronous one? On the talent side, on the fellowship, a lot of folks in our community lost their internships and jobs when COVID happened. And we had to invent an alternative to that. Like, what could we give them over that summer of 2020 that would give them a similar level of professional experience where they could go get a job the following year? And it ended up being like a distributed internship, right? Like, how do we get people with a lot of disparate skills, locations, interests, match to projects and mentors, and build something that would actually get them from, like, you know, never having worked on a production code base before to, wow, I'm competent and can get a job. And that required a ton of experimentation and, like, you know, for lack of a better term, innovation in what we actually provided to our community members. But at the time, it felt very insurmountable, right? Like, contracts were drying up, events weren't running. You know, there were a lot of problems all at once that we had to overcome.
Given this experience now, what, 10 years at MLH, how do you measure success? What are the things that you report back to people who matter?
The thing that matters most to us is impact. We just passed our millionth developer after 10 years, which is a huge milestone that we basically missed because our team was so focused on just, like, doing stuff. And literally someone, like, pulled up a dashboard one day and was like, oh, wow, we passed a million. So it was really exciting once we realized that that had happened. More importantly than that, though, like, the thing that we consistently hear from people in our community is that being part of it is a life-changing experience for them. You know, in raw numbers, like, something like 40% of the people who participate say that being part of MLH changed their life. But I hear it anecdotally all the time. Like, I go to meetups for professionals, like, in the industry, where they say that, like, going to hackathons, going into the MLH fellowship, like, being part of these clubs on campus was their formative experience as a developer. And that's the thing that matters most to us. Like, all of the things that we do for corporate partners, you know, is a means of enabling that in a mutually beneficial way, right? Like, why would we care about introducing developers to some generic API? The reason we care is because when you're going into the industry, if you don't understand how developer platforms work and how APIs work and how to use a lot of these bleeding edge tools, you're going to be left behind. Like, they're a core part of a tool belt. They're a core part of being a professional engineer. And, you know, I think that all of those impact metrics tie together in a really, like, virtuous cycle of, we provide a life-changing experience, it changes the trajectory of people's careers, and both the individuals involved and the companies involved get a ton of value out of it.
And so those, you were so focused on those people that matter, the developers that matter, that you missed the million developer mark.
It's true.
So looking back, knowing what you do now, what would you advise yourself 10 years ago as you were starting out?
I think the biggest piece of advice I would give myself is not to look at what other people are doing. I think that there is a huge difference between comparing yourself to other companies and trying to emulate strategies that have worked elsewhere versus understanding what those strategies are and seeking advice and then coming to your own conclusion. Like, I think that myself personally, like, it was always really easy for me to see someone else and be like, oh my God, they're so far ahead of us. Oh wow. Like, they're doing this thing that's, like, so successful. Like, why aren't we able to do that? And the truth is that, like, we had our own way to go about things. And in many cases it worked out better for us. In a lot of cases, it didn't, but it was really important to go on that journey of figuring it out for ourselves, of what is the MLH way of doing something, because that's what differentiates you as a community and as a company, is figuring out your own path forward, even if you're integrating, you know, well-understood strategies and advice.
Great. Well, John, thank you.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully this was interesting and, you know, helpful for you guys. I enjoyed it.